Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. Joining us back on the programme is Nadia Cohen, who's written numerous historical and contemporary biographies of authors like A.A. Milne, Roald Dahl and Enid Blyton. Her new book, The Real Beatrix Potter, gives an insight into a trailblazing feminist who bought her own farm without any help from a man, a scandalous thing to do at that time. She didn't marry till she was 47, when it was far too late for her to have children, so she left all her property and over 4,000 acres of land to the National Trust. Also with us is Mary Wood, who first put pen to paper in 1989 and is now a best-selling novelist. Her latest historical saga, The Brave Daughters, is the fourth book in the Girls Who Went to War series. Also joining us is Caroline Hulse, the best-selling author of The Adults, which has been optioned for TV. Her new book, Like a House on Fire, is full of black humour, family drama and a murder mystery with an explosive end. And finally on tonight's book show is B.P. Walter, who works as a social media coordinator for Waterstones, based in their HQ in Piccadilly. His second book, Hold Your Breath, is a gripping and suspenseful thriller that will captivate you from first to last page. That's tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Drench yourself in words unspoken, live your life.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Nadia Cohen, an author who's written numerous historical and contemporary biographies. The Real Beatrix Potter is the latest in a series of fascinating in-depth biographies about apparently whimsical children storytellers who actually hid a darker side behind the public facade. We've had her on the book show talking about the extraordinary life of A.A. Milne, as well as the real Roald Dahl and the real Enid Blyton. But today is the turn of Beatrix Potter. Welcome to the show, Nadia.
Hi, Hannah. Great to speak to you again.
Lovely to have you back with us as well. And Beatrix Potter. So I think of all the authors that you've done so far, Beatrix Potter maybe is someone that people might know a little bit more about. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. I think she has been firmly established as a favourite of children for generations, really. She may have been the first books that many children saw as kids. They were sort of stuck up on the shelves. They've always been a lovely christening present or early birthday present for kids. So I think everybody has some sort of dim awareness of her, even if they can't name more characters than Peter Rabbit himself.
And I'm sure a lot of people would already associate her with the Lake District. And also I knew the fact about the fact that she amazingly left all of her property and over 4,000 acres of land to the National Trust.
Yeah, it was one of the more interesting legacies she left behind. She had a very conventional Victorian upbringing, but her parents decided it wasn't worth sending her to school because as a woman, she was just expected to marry and have children, but she never did that. She wasn't interested in that. So when she did eventually buy up this land, which we can talk about a bit later, she had no one to leave it to. So she bequeathed it all to the nation. And it was about over 4,000 acres by that stage. And that became the early seeds of the National Trust because she left it with very tight regulations around it that it couldn't be developed. So the Lake District couldn't be spoiled, which was something she'd campaigned against her entire adult life. She was very worried about holidaymakers coming in and ruining the place she loved so much. Mm. So she ensured that even after she died, it would remain as beautiful as it is now.
Mm, wonderful. And she didn't marry until she was 47.
No, she couldn't stand her very stifling upbringing. Her parents really wanted her to marry well, to marry an aristocrat and get them some more money. And she was paraded around all these balls and parties, which she hated. She hated being squeezed into uncomfortable dresses and having to talk about the weather. She wanted to teach herself. So she would sort of go off into her bedroom where she'd take in hedgehogs and mice and frogs, and she'd boil them up and dissect the bones without her parents realizing. She was a proper tomboy. And any chance she could get, she would sneak out to an art gallery or out to the countryside to teach herself to sketch, to draw, to write, to study. She did, when she first published Peter Rabbit, the publisher fell in love with her, and they were due to get married, but unfortunately he died just a month after he proposed. And she was heartbroken. So that's when she fled to the Lake District to grieve in private because her parents were very unsympathetic. They said he was a tradesman and she shouldn't have married him anyway because he worked in publishing. So she went off to the Lake District to what was going to be their holiday home to grieve in private. And there she fell in love again with a local solicitor. But by the time they married, she was 47. So it was far too late for her to have children of her own. So everything she left behind, she left to the nation.
And do you think she was upset about the fact that she couldn't have children, or was it something she never really wanted?
I don't think it was something she ever really wanted. She was never like other girls or women of her generation. She wanted to be like the boys. She was furious that her brother was sent off to boarding school to learn and that he was able to buy property and she never could. Because at that time, of course, women couldn't buy property without the help of a man. They needed their husband or father to help them out. And that infuriated her. She was very much a trailblazing feminist years ahead of her time, before that expression was even known. She wouldn't have known what you meant by a feminist, but she was one. And when she became an employer, she employed hundreds of men working on all of her farms. She refused to pay the men themselves. She would go around and hand the cash to their wives because she said she couldn't trust the men not to spend it inappropriately, by which she meant in the pub. So she thought men couldn't be trusted anyway. She wanted to work with women. She hired a district nurse when she realized women were dying in childbirth. That worried her. She was very pro-women at a time way before that was fashionable.
Interesting. And she did actually buy her own farm without any financial help from a man, which was scandalous at the time.
It was. And that was how she met her second husband. She went to a local solicitor and said she wanted to buy a small farm that had come on the market. And he was the only person who wasn't shocked, but instead said, OK, I'll help. He smoothed the transaction through, of course, being a man and being known in the area. She was known as an offcomer, which is what they called outsiders in the Lake District, because she was from London and they didn't like people coming up from London and buying up all the property. But he helped her and they gradually fell in love. They never actually lived together. They lived in two neighbouring farmhouses. But he helped her carry on buying up properties whenever they came on the market. And she ended up buying hundreds of farms, thousands of acres of land, which she chose strategically to ensure that developers couldn't widen the roads or build unsightly developments, because conservation was very much her passion.
So she was a very clever lady.
She was. She was. She was extremely clever and entirely self-taught. No one ever helped her with anything. But she met a local one of her family holidays to the Lake District. She met the local vicar, who was a man called Canon Rawnsley, who she was enchanted by. He was a passionate, well, we'd call him an eco-warrior now. He was on a passionate crusade to save the Lake District. by he would storm into planning meetings and make angry speeches or write impassioned letters to the newspapers, angrily saying we can't just have anybody coming to the Lake District on their holidays because we'd need to build more hotels and pubs and amusements for them. And she was very taken in by this. And together, in their long hours of discussions, they decided they needed to start a charity that could eventually have enough money to buy up all these places of interest and protect them forever. And that was how the National Trust came to be.
Mm, wow. And in terms of her relationship with animals, how would you describe it? I mean, was she an avid animal lover? I mean, you mentioned that she dissected animals herself, which I think would be difficult for an animal lover to do.
I'm not sure she loved animals as pets, as we would see it today. She didn't think they were cute and fluffy, although, of course, that's how they come across in her little white books. She was interested in the way they moved and the way they scurried about. And she would she surprised her friends. She would suddenly plonk herself down in the street if she saw something interesting she wanted to draw, which horrified sort of genteel Victorian ladies. She grew up in Victorian London, in Kensington, in a big house with lots of servants, which she hated. But they had lots of friends and family who had country estates. So whenever she could, she would escape out of London and spend as much time as she could in the countryside, where she would study the anatomy of animals, really, and the way they moved. And when her pet hedgehog died, she kept it and stuffed it with wool so she could arrange it into positions to teach, to learn to draw it, which was perhaps where Mrs. Tiggywinkle came from.
Yes.
She did get to spend on farms and in the countryside. She found it all fascinating because it was such a far cry from her very stuffy life in Kensington.
So what were some of the things that you found out about her when doing the research that you really didn't know before?
I felt it was very, her personal life was very interesting. I think she was very frustrated and angry as a child and a teenager. She always thought there must be more to life than this. But even though nobody helped her, she found a way of doing it herself, which I found quite inspiring. You know, she would write in her journals, which she was convinced that her mother would try and read. So she wrote them all in code. And later on in life, they discovered these reams and reams of closely coded books, which it was only long after she died that an enthusiastic fan was able to decode them. And in them, she writes about how frustrated she was and how she wanted to go to art galleries, which you couldn't do as an unaccompanied woman. She wrote a lot about mycology and studied fungus, which again wasn't a very ladylike thing to do. And she went to the researchers at Kew Gardens and said that she had all this groundbreaking research, but they wouldn't take her seriously because she was female. But she managed to get a couple of hers to go and present the paper to the directors as his own. And they were blown away and they said this was all groundbreaking and amazing. And he got all these plaudits. But when they found out it was actually had been written by a woman, it was all discredited. She was back to
my goodness, how awful.
Yeah, so she was really frustrated. Her father was an enthusiastic photographer when photography was a new trend then. So he would occasionally take her to art galleries, but she never really got to do what she wanted until she eventually got to the Lakes, where she lived completely anonymously. Nobody knew she was Beatrix Potter. She was known as Mrs. Helis, as her took her husband's name. And it was only after she died that a lot of her neighbours read obituaries and realised that's who she was. She just wanted to get on with it. She wanted to be left in peace. She was invited abroad. She was hugely famous in America, but she never went. She never wanted to give interviews. She loved being reclusive, and she hid herself away really until for probably the last 30, 40 years of her life. She had very few friends. She lived very humbly. I mean, she's a multimillionaire many times over by today's standards. She would have been the equivalent of J.K. Rowling, perhaps. She was hugely famous, but she didn't even bother having electricity installed in her house. She just wanted a quiet, humble life.
Mm. So is that the sort of darker side that we talk about? There's nothing more kind of sinister that we don't know about, is there?
I don't think so. I mean, I think she was lots of children who remember her. There are still a few people alive who knew her when they were kids say she was very grouchy. Somebody suggested she slapped them once, although that was later. there was an argument about whether that was another grumpy old lady in the village. I think she was moody. She would stomp about. She would dress in a very masculine way. She was unfriendly. People would mistake her for a tramp sometimes. They'd see her coming down the lane sort of with a sack wrapped around her. But she didn't care. She didn't really care about people or relationships. She just lived a frugal, quiet life. She just couldn't be bothered. She enjoyed her anonymity.
Fascinating, isn't it? Because people, very few people can get away with doing that today, can't they? I suppose, I mean, things have changed massively, of course, with the invention of the internet and social media and paparazzi and things like that. I mean, you would be very difficult to live like that now, wouldn't it?
Well, even then, you say that, but she was surprisingly in demand and people would track her down. Not just fans, but publishers in America would sailed over to Britain, travelled up to the Lake District and to knock on her door because, as you say, there was no other way of communicating with her. And she was normally would send them packing. But she was astounded once when these two women from a magazine in New York knocked on her door and said, you know, they really wanted her to write for this children's literacy magazine. And she was very impressed. And that was one of the few publicity things she did do. Other people would come and see her, and usually they were men, and she wasn't interested in talking to men. She found them annoying and loud. And you know, one man apparently came from Boston in America with a huge sum of cash, which he left on the table for her. But she didn't want it. She was never interested in all the trappings of fame and fortune that she could have had. She bought her mother a lovely house, but really all the money she spent was on farms and lands, which she could collect to leave to the nation after she died. And she spent every penny she had. And every time she wanted a new place would come on the market, which her husband would point out for her, she'd quickly dash off another book. So which is why there are so many of those little white books, because when she needed money, she'd write another one.
How wonderful. An amazing story. I mean, really fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think she was something of a genius. I mean, there was never anything like that. She never, as we've said, she wasn't trained in art or literacy at all. The story started out as letters she would send. When all of her friends started getting married and having children, but she didn't, she would send these long illustrated letters to her friends' kids. And it was only later that one of her friends said, you should publish these. They're lovely. You know, the little illustrations of the rabbits running through the words.
Mm.
And so she sent off the first one, which was Peter Rabbit, to numerous publishers, but they weren't interested. But of course, as soon as one did spot the potential, they all wanted it. And then she was in massive demand. But it was never something that got her very excited. She was just, I think until then, she was bored and she was just pleased to have something to do. But then when she got to the lake, she was so busy. That's all she wanted to do. She did all the farming herself. She'd be out there in all weathers, doing everything that was needed. She worked like a man. She joined the labourers out in the fields, out in the barns, whenever she could.
Wow.
Which would have been quite scandalous for a lady of her background at the time.
Yes, what a woman. Well, it's been lovely to learn more about Beatrix Potter. Thank you, Nadia. If people want to get a copy of the book, it's called The Real Beatrix Potter, and it's by Nadia Cohen, who we've been chatting to. Nadia, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Hannah.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Mary Wood, who was born the 13th child of 15 to a middle-class mother and an East End barrow boy. Mary's family was poor but rich in love. She raised four children and has numerous grandchildren, step-grandchildren and great-grandchildren. An avid reader, she first put pen to paper in 1989 and is now a full-time novelist. She is back with us on the Book Show to talk about her latest novel, The Brave Daughters. It's the fourth book in the Girls Who Went to War series. Welcome to the Book Show, Mary.
Hello. Hello, everybody. It's lovely to be back again. Thank you.
It's great to have you back with us. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Lockdown in Spain. I should have been home by now, but we're taking each day as it comes and enjoying it now that we can go out for a walk. That's
yes.
Absolutely lovely.
Yes, exactly. Whereabouts are you in Spain?
I'm in the Murcia region in Ilaplana.
Ah, nice. Okay. Well, we're slightly further down the coast, Marbella way, but we broadcast in Murcia, so you can at least enjoy TRE while you're there.
Yes.
So I have to ask you about your beginnings. What made you start writing back in 1989?
Well, that was in pen and paper days, of course, because not many of us had word processors. And I was actually had a book in me for a long time, as a lot can probably relate to that. And then suddenly and sadly, my mum became ill and needed taking full-time care. And I was the only one at the time that wasn't sort of on a career path and could do this much-needed work. So the rest of the family chipped in and paid me a wage, bless them, rather than have mum put into a home. And I looked after mum. It was a labour of love. And while she was sleeping in the afternoon, I got a pad and pen and started to jot down this story that I'd always had. And it just took me from there like an addiction, really.
Oh, wonderful. And how do you know how many books you've written now?
Yes, I've written 23 altogether. I didn't actually, career and family got in the way after that, and I just wrote in my spare time. But I didn't actually try again until I retired in 2009, and then my career took off in stages from there. So since then, I've written 23 books. There's 14 published in Mary Wood's name, and then I write under another name, Maggie Mason. But I've got three waiting to be published, and one of those is The Brave Daughter, so, which is out on the 14th of May.
Yes, fantastic. So tell me about the Girls Who Went to War series.
Okay, well, this series really fascinated me to write, and I took care to write each book so that it could be read alone. And yet was part of a series. So the three girls start off in World War One, and they meet on the platform of a station in London. They're all in the Red Cross, and they're all being sent to Belgium to help out with the nurses. They are Red Cross nurses. And they get trapped there because of the invasion. But and this is based on a sort of a real-life research that I found. They escaped across the line together, and they made them nearly brilliant friendship. However, each one had a story of their own. Each one had adversity in their life. So the first book goes on to tell Flora's story, and that's called The Forgotten Daughter. And the second book is Ella's story, and that's called The Abandoned Daughter. And the third one is Mag's story, and that is called The Wrong Daughter, and at the moment is only 99p as a Kindle deal through May. So, woohoo, time to have a little go. And then the next one, the next one is called The Brave Daughters, and that is, we've moved now on to the Flora's, Mag's and Ella's children, the next generation, as they fight the Second World War and take up various roles in that. So it's a gritty and emotional read, taking in the French Revolution, land girls, all sorts of roles that the women took on and the young men took on in the Second World War.
I bet you do a lot of research for these books.
I do. I travel and research, which is wonderful, as well as internet and libraries, the usual route, but I travel. So for this one, I travelled to Laurent-de-Hérault in France and Narbonne, Scotland, London and Blackburn.
Cool.
And because that is all the different settings that you visit in the book. But as I say, each book can be read alone. So if you haven't read the first ones, you can, you know, pick up any of them and get into them on their own and hopefully have a taste to pick up the others too.
Yes. And does it make a difference travelling to these places? Because obviously you're setting books in, well, this particular one in the Second World War. These places, of course, changed dramatically, thankfully, since the war. So how does it help?
It does help. It helps to get a feel for the place. The village of Laurent de Hérault and Narbonne haven't really changed very much at all. They're very historic villages. So the setting is just how it would have been. And I even was able to choose a house that they lived in. I had a tea at the little cafe there. And I just got the feel of the place, and I could see my girls there, you know, all my characters there. And Narbonne, again, is the same. It's more or less just the same, really. Scotland was Port Patrick. So, again, no changes there, really. Old buildings that were there at the time of the war and everything. Blackburn was too. I worked in Blackburn, so that was a different matter. I know the Blackburn people and the dialect and everything. So, because I tried to bring a little tiny bit of the dialect in to give a flavour.
And whereabouts in London?
Yes, it was really useful. London, it was the sort of area where the War Office was at the time, because one of the gentlemen in the book was a main man there, and I sort of needed to know his sort of steps, even if he went for a cup of tea, if you like. Not always in the book. It's strange. I don't always put these things in the book, but I can seep them into me so that when I'm writing about anywhere or the character, it's alive to me.
Yes.
It's not somewhere that I'm pretending about, you know.
Yes, that really makes a lot of sense. And tell us more about the daughters, the two main characters in this book, then.
Well, the main ones are Sibby and Margie. First of all, they go to Digby and are wireless operators. But they both speak languages because of Margie being brought up in France with the French side of the family, and Sibby being brought up in England but visiting Margie a lot. And they both speak French, and Margie speaks some Polish as well because of her mum Ella being Polish. So we do have the Jewish element in the story as well, which is very sad. And so because of this skill being identified, they are taken in to be special agents, and they are assigned to France to the Marquise, which was a French resistance organization. Their story is the main story, but then we have Ella, Flores and Mag's story and the people relating to them as well. So it's mainly centred in France, but there's a lot of separation of people, all the kind of war emotions and grit that you would expect.
And do you know how many more books there's going to be in this series?
This is the last one. There aren't any more planned. No, I've gone on to a series called The Jam Factory Girls, which I've written two of the books, but they're not yet published. So that's for Pam Macmillan. The next sort of series is about girls who worked in the jam factory before the war, well, early on, you know, in the early 1900s.
Fantastic. So you like writing about women in history then, was that fair to say?
I do, yes. And friendships, I love the idea of strong women in friendships, helping each other and getting through emotional happenings. And yes, that's what I like a lot doing and writing about. It's you know, I'm not so much a contemporary writer, but more living in history.
Why not? There's so much great material there, isn't there?
Oh, there is. It's amazing. You come across some amazing women in your research who haven't really had, you know, the accolade they should have had. You know, they haven't been honoured. I know that it is catching up with that now, thank goodness. But the men were automatically honoured and sought out and, you know, featured. But some of the women, the things that they did were just absolutely, you know, brave, courageous, and they weren't honoured for them at the time. And I'm rooting all these women out and sort of setting stories around what they did.
Yes, very important. We appreciate you doing that.
Thank you.
If people want to get a copy of your latest book, it's called The Brave Daughters, and it's by Mary Wood. It's available to buy on our website, tre.radio. Mary, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it, and I hope I can come again.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Caroline Hulse. She's the best-selling author of The Adults, which has been optioned for TV by Tiger Aspect. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel, full of black humour and family drama. It's called Like a House on Fire. Welcome to the book show, Caroline.
Hi, Hannah. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. So is this a similar sort of family drama to the first one, or is it very different, would you say?
No, it's quite similar in tone. I think in all my books, they tend to be about people who mean well, doing things really badly, and things going wrong. So it's really similar in tone. It's basically a story of a divorcing couple who haven't told their family they're divorcing, and they decide to go and play nice at one last family party, which is a murder mystery party. And their aim is just to make it through the day without the breakup being discovered. And yeah, that doesn't work. And there's lots of secrets, and there's lots that comes out. So it basically ends in carnage. I don't think that's a spoiler.
So I guess a lot of people can probably relate to various issues that families may have with each other.
Yes. Yeah, I think the adult sibling relationship's really interesting. I think, you know, when you've got elderly parents and adult children and their power dynamics, you know, some of the social change that's going on and the different aspects of that and how they react to it. I mean, it's all kind of in there, just playing out over the course of a day. And of course, the long-held resentments and long-held, you know, concerns, all underpinned with love, that can make these days quite, I don't know, quite trying. Obviously, while we're in lockdown at the moment, it's quite a strange time to talk about this stuff. But it's, you know, stories from the time when, you know, you could see your family, but you didn't always appreciate it.
Yes. Yeah, it's making us appreciate these things a lot more now, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
So let's talk about the couple in question. What can you tell us about them?
So it's Stella and George. So they have been together for, I think it's 11 years, and their relationship has just been, I think, is decayed over the 11-year period. So they tend to just keep having the same rows, and it ends, I think it's a few months before the party, so they decide to live separately. But just because of challenges within the wider family, so there's one of the mothers has cancer, that it will be perceived as quite a disappointment. They haven't told any of their family that this is what's happening. So they just think that they will be able to go to this one last party. It's an anniversary party that the mother has arranged, who has cancer, who really wants to have this one last families together party. They think they'll be able to manage that. They think they'll be able to hide things. But of course, there are resentments within that relationship still. And obviously them being placed within the wider cauldron of the family, it doesn't go quite as they would have wanted.
And how many other people are in the family and at this party?
In the wider family, there are two other adult siblings, one of whom is inexplicably delayed for the party and is being eagerly awaited. And so then there's the two parents, and then one of the siblings has two children. And then, of course, there's other characters. So it's not just family. There are other characters there playing characters in the murder mystery and, you know, adding to the fun and games, really.
And do you plan the characters quite carefully beforehand? Do you kind of work that out, or do they just become part of the story as you write?
I plan them very carefully, but they do change. So I really spend a lot of time before I sit down and actually start writing. I do absolutely tons of planning, but you don't know which way it's going to go, and some things don't work, and some ideas that seem really good at the time then just can seem crass on paper or too subtle. So, yeah, they do change over the time. And I think between the first draft and probably the final draft, I just nail them down a lot more to the really important bits.
So when you're editing and things, can things change quite a lot?
Yes, I think, quite drastically. I think structurally my books change a lot, but also, as you say, character. I think by the end of the book, you know the character so much better than you do at the beginning, and then you can really hone in on the important bits and cut out a lot of the filler, I think, as you go through. I think when I'm editing, I just try and make every scene work an awful lot harder than it does in the first draft. So I'm trying to make sure it's advancing the plot, but it's also saying something about character and also doing something funny and hopefully having a few callbacks to other chapters in the book. So, yeah, those sorts of things mean that from a first draft to a final draft, it can feel really, really different.
Mm. It must be weird when you finish the book after you've got to know these characters really well. Do you ever miss them?
That's a good one. I don't. So at the moment, it's nice to be reacquainted with them. I mean, I finished this book quite a long time ago, so I've re-listened to it on audiobook and reread it just to remind myself and, you know, stay really in touch. And it has been really nice seeing the characters again, and I still feel sorry for them, and I do feel like I torture my characters quite a lot, so kind of work out what they want the least, and then that's kind of what happens to them during the story. So I think as I do read it, sometimes I think, oh, I'm not very nice to these people, am I? They really, you know, they mean well, and look what's happening, exactly what they don't want.
And do you use kind of inspiration from people you know in your own life?
Yeah, I definitely take little bits, and hopefully not too much. I was really careful with this one because in a way it is quite close to home. So, you know, I have a family. You know, we get together sometimes. So for that reason, you know, I was trying to be really, really careful to make sure it doesn't resemble too closely. But, you know, you can't help it, I think. And I certainly take... I think, you know, with characterization, I just notice things about people as they walk around, and then you just change things a little bit and then put it into a different kind of character and hope it's not too obvious, and hope that no one would ever notice and think, hang on, that's me. Because, you know, the characters are so many different parts all put together, really. I would hope no one would think they'd been lifted and shifted to my book. And my dad did say when he read this book, he went, no one's going to think this is us, are they? I said, well, I hope not, Dad. I hope not.
Yeah. And tell me about the adults being optioned for TV. That sounds exciting.
Yeah, that was really exciting. So that was optioned by Tiger Aspect, who do Peaky Blinders and very, very many other things. It's one of those things you don't even think about. I don't know, when I finished my first book a long, long time ago, because I wrote some that were unpublished, like most authors, I never really thought beyond an actual book. So the idea that it could one day be turned into a TV show is really exciting. And I think when I met with the production company and they were asking questions like, you know, does the location matter, and what matters about the characters to you, and that kind of thing, it just felt like a dream. And I think... because so many parts of the writing process can often be a tiny bit worrying. I think they're a tiny bit like, well, how's this review going to go? Or is this good enough? Or, you know, am I happy with this? And I think this was one part of the process that was just absolute pure pleasure, because I know nothing about TV apart from, you know, as a viewer. So I can't input, really. I can't, you know, it's not my place to have a strong view. So all I can do is really sit back and enjoy it. And I have to say that meeting with Ty Grasper was probably one of the highlights of the process so far.
So it sounds like it could be happening in the near future then, because these things can take ages. But if you've actually had a meeting and they've asked you questions like that, that sounds quite far along.
Well, that was a little while ago. So I think it will still be a little way away. And I think, you know, I have no doubt that the world situation that we've got now is, you know, I'm sure means that things are as much up in the air for people in that industry as every other industry. So I think, as with all this stuff, I'm trying to enjoy that it's happened, you know, have high hopes that good things will happen, but, you know, not expectations, really. I would absolutely love to be able to tell you it's going to be on screen in 6 months or a year, but I think that's probably unrealistic.
Yeah.
But you never know. I think it will be. There's an imaginary rabbit in that book. So that would be very interesting to see how that is represented on TV. I'm not quite sure how they're going to do it, because the imaginary rabbit is actually quite a significant character, and I hope that doesn't put off anyone listening. It makes sense if you read the book, but yeah, I would be very interested to see how they did that.
Have you fantasized about some of the who would play some of the human roles in the series?
So I try not to. I don't know, because the characters are so specific that nobody, I can't picture anyone go, they are like this person, because I think the characters become so real by the end of the book, as I'm sure you know when you write. And I think, I wouldn't say there are people that I would go, oh, they should definitely be played by this person. But when I met with Ty Grasper, they showed me a list of, you know, fantasy casting and their ideas for each character. And I have to say that was, again, one of the things that was so much fun, you know, going, oh, would they work? Would they work? But I think, as I say, with this, I'm trying to be a little bit hands-off, because I recognise that they are experts, and I've written the book, but making a good TV show is very good, different from a good book.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to enjoy the ride.
Fair enough. Sounds very sensible. Well, if people want to get a copy of the latest book, it's called Like a House on Fire, and it's by Caroline Hulse, who we've been chatting to on the book show today. Caroline, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line from the UK is Barnaby Walter, who works as a social media coordinator for Waterstones, based at their HQ in Piccadilly. He's with us on the book show to talk about his second novel. It's called Hold Your Breath. Welcome to the book show, Barnaby.
Hello, it's lovely to be here.
Ah, it's great to have you. Thanks for joining us. So what's it like working for Waterstones? I imagine it must be great fun, especially being in their HQ.
Yes, it is. Yes, I've worked for Waterstones since I was 16, and originally as a bookseller in the shop. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I made the journey to head office to coordinate the social media. And it's a dream, really, because I get to work with books every day and see different sides of the industry, and it's lovely to be able to talk to people online about books and recommend books that they can be reading. So yeah, it's great fun.
Fantastic. And has it sort of inspired you to become an author yourself?
I think so. I think being around books was certainly a source of great inspiration. I've always been a voracious reader, and I think putting the books on the tables and seeing others' authors' kind of dreams come true was something that probably helped spur me on.
So tell me about, before we talk about your latest book, how did your first book do? How did you decide what you were going to write about?
Well, the first book that I got published actually wasn't the first book I wrote. I wrote two more before it, but I sent those out, and I didn't get an agent with those. But I got lots of nice responses saying, this isn't it, but carry on trying, and we'd like to read anything else you do. So with the one that I got published, I actually went to a creative writing course called the Faber Academy, which was absolutely brilliant, headed up by the author Rowan Coleman. And it was a book I wrote as my work in progress whilst at the Faber Academy. And It was during the time when psychological thrillers were really going huge, and I knew I really wanted to write a psychological thriller because they were the books that I enjoyed writing and enjoyed reading. And it was really wonderful to have a work in progress that I could do as kind of my homework for the course and share with the other people there and get feedback. And yeah, it was a really lovely process, and that was how my first one came about.
And did it feel quite natural to you when you started writing?
Yes, it did. Yeah. When I first started writing, it was when I graduated from my MA, and my master's was in film and cultural management, very much in the kind of how one packages and sells creative products rather than the creation of them. And I originally thought I was going to go into film distribution or some kind of marketing. And I knew that wasn't creative enough for me at that point. I knew I wanted to do something creative, and I thought about going into filmmaking, but with filmmaking you're relying a lot on other people's time and money rather than just your own, whereas if you're writing a novel, it's literally just you in a room writing it by yourself. So I decided to try writing a novel, and when I started doing it, I realized that's what I absolutely loved and would love to carry on doing it.
So is this another psychological thriller, would you say?
My second one is, yes, it's Hold Your Breath is slightly more creepy, I'd say. It's set in a dark, menacing forest in the middle of the night in the 1980s. And in the middle of the forest, there's rather horrible things that, end up happening. And it's slightly different to the first one. The first one was very much, one could call it kind of domestic thriller. It was set very much in the home, or some of it was set within the dorms of a university. And it was quite internal, quite within kind of closed walls, whereas this one, it's kind of opened out a bit more and it's got more of a menacing kind of forest backdrop.
Really. Mm. And what about the main character, Kitty? What can you tell us about her?
The book is split between narration of her as an adult and her as a child. The majority of it is her as a child. And when she's 10 years old, she's suddenly taken from a suburban life to a cottage in the middle of the woods by her father. And it's all to do with the situation involving her mother. Her mother is her mental health is deteriorating. She's having quite alarming hallucinations or visions. And her father takes her mother there to help her get better. And steadily, you realise that there's plans afoot that may be more sinister than they first seem. But Kitty is having to witness all of it, and we hear from her kind of child's viewpoint what that's like. And steadily as it goes on, we realise that something really terrible happened in the middle of the forest, and we hear from both her as an adult and her as a child as how that affected her entire life, really.
And was that the plan from the beginning, that you wanted to tell it in two parts, one as her as a child and as an adult?
Originally, I wrote it with her as a child, and then the adult bit was the very final part of the novel. And through conversations with my agent and reading back through the book, I realised it kind of needed something to help spur it on. And eventually, it became quite natural to insert chapters here and there of her as an adult, so we can get a glimpse of the effect that whatever happened there has had on her as an adult character. And that, I think, helps increase the suspense of what actually did happen, and helps kind of drive the reader on to find out the mystery at the book's core. So that slightly came on a little bit later. I'm always fascinated how a book can change quite a bit during the editing stage. This one didn't change that much, actually. It was mostly the same. But that bit was afterwards. It was kind of during the edits where we felt that introduced another layer of intrigue, I think, to the book.
Mm. And are you obviously felt it yourself, so I guess that made it easy, but are you okay about making big changes to books? You know, it must be hard, I guess, sometimes if you've written something and you think it's okay, and then discussions with an agent or editor, you end up having to get rid of bits or change bits. Is that difficult sometimes?
I'm very lucky that I haven't had anything suggested yet or any conversations yet that have made me think, oh my goodness, no, I can't possibly do that. And I'm sure there are authors that have been in that situation. And so far, with my lovely editors at HarperCollins and my brilliant agent, Joanna, we've always been very much on the same page of where the book's going, particularly with this one. and with A Version of the Truth. Both of them have been really good, I think, efforts during the editing process. It hasn't been too too distracting. It is difficult sometimes when you feel like you've got everything set in stone, and then something comes along and says, actually, maybe this would be a better way of doing it, or maybe we need to kind of tweak this bit here. And at the time, it can feel like kind of doing major surgery to something that's already kind of nice and complete. But I think in the end, it is always worthwhile. And I think the scrutiny that the editing process puts upon a book is helps it kind of stand up to the test that the reader will put it through.
Mm, definitely. And when do you find the time to write if you're working for Waterstones? Do you write in the evening or are you up early?
I actually find it very difficult, and partly I find it it bothers me a bit that the things that I love so much with writing, I kind of have to cram in here and there. But normally when we're in kind of normal circumstances, I actually write during lunch times. I usually go to a Cafe Nero or a Costa or somewhere and write for an hour, and that's quite a nice change to the day. But currently under lockdown, I found that very hard to do. I think it's because I'm kind of in the same place working on my laptop, and I don't really fancy doing that for another hour over lunch. Currently during this very strange situation we're in, I've mostly just been writing at the weekends. But under normal circumstances, I write probably about an hour every weekday, and then at the weekends, that's when I really do properly a proper amount.
Yeah. Well, if people want to get a copy of your latest book, it's called Hold Your Breath, and it's by Barnaby Walter, who we've been chatting to, although it says on the book BP Walter, so yes. People should look out for it. Why did you do that?
That was my publisher's suggestion, actually. I think a variety of reasons. I think Barnaby is a slightly unusual name and maybe a bit distracting on the book cover. I'm not sure. But
I love the name Barnaby.
Thank you, Ren. But yeah, I think there's a lot of authors now that seem to initial their names. Particularly in the genre, it seems to be quite familiar, I think, for readers. So we went with BP Walter.
Fair enough. Well, it's available to buy on our website, so listeners can get a copy from the bookshop section on tre.radio. Barnaby, thanks for joining us and best of luck with it.
Thank you very much for speaking to me. It's been a joy.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.